stronger than you know. Let the fire in your heart begin to grow. Loving me is enough. I'm breaking through the dark, shining with my truth and lighting up my
Hey, hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Loving Me Is Enough podcast. I'm your girl, Natasha Hatchett, and this podcast is where we talk about real life situations and our trauma. We not only talk about it, we learn, we process, and we heal through it. So let's get into it. Last 2 weeks, we've been talking about things that's causing us trauma and causing us to go through different type of cycles. And today is no different. We're going to talk about breaking cycles that you did not create. We talked about birthday traumas, how birthdays was a trauma for me, how it was a trigger for me. And last week we talked about when childhood doesn't stay in childhood. And today we're going to be breaking cycles you did not create. Some of us have inherited form of pain from our past, from our parents that we didn't even know that we had, right? But we don't necessarily have to pass it on. We all, to some extent, are living out patterns that we didn't consciously choose. And in this episode today, I want us to identify those circles and begin making intentional changes. One of the hardest truths to accept We can repeat what has hurt us. Even when we promise ourselves we would never, ever repeat the pattern of behavior. You ever find yourself saying things like, I will never be like my parents, then one day comes along and you hear their words coming out your mouth. You find yourself acting like them, talking like them, responding like them, and handling conflict like them. We find ourselves in relationships that mirror the very dynamic that we promised ourselves that we would never repeat. And it's not because we're destined to repeat the past, because here's the thing. What's unhealed often becomes familiar. If we don't heal the trauma, like we talked about last week, we will continue to perpetuate the behavior. We will continue to do things that we claim that we would never, ever do. As I'm getting older, I'm realizing as I look in the mirror, intentional, unintentional, I'm starting to physically look more like my mother. Not a bad thing. She's a beautiful woman at the age that she is. However, I'm also starting to recognize some pattern of behavior that I've picked up along the way from my mom and from my dad. Some are good. Some are bad. And if we're honest, I kind of perpetuate the bad at times because it works in my favor. At least I think it does. Either way, it's patterns of behavior that if I'm not careful, the child that I gave birth to will continue to perpetuate the behavior. And that's the cycle that I'm trying to break. So we're going to be trying to intentionally break those cycles so our children don't have to perpetuate the same behavior. Where do you start? How do I start? Glad you asked. The first thing we need to realize and recognize is family patterns. The things that we inherit aren't always things that we choose. One of the greatest misconceptions about healing is believing that if we don't like what we've experienced growing up, we automatically won't repeat it. That's a lie from the pits of hell. Because even if you don't like it, not liking it is not enough to say I won't repeating it. Unfortunately, that's not how emotional patterns work. That's not how life cycles tend to work. We have this saying called out of sight, out of mind. We think because we're no longer in our parents' house, we're no longer doing this, we're no longer doing that, that, you know, we're good, we're safe. I'm not going to repeat that pattern. I'm not going to repeat that cycle with my child. Well, that's not necessarily true. What I've learned over the years in my early years as a teacher, in another life, I taught somebody's children. Children are like sponges. Long before we develop our own beliefs, we absorb the beliefs, the behaviors, the communication styles, and the coping mechanisms of the people that's raising us. So however you saw your mother, your father, your caregiver, whomever you was raised in the home with, whatever you saw them do to deal with conflict, that's more than likely what you'll do. Whatever you saw them do in their marriage, in their relationship, more than likely that's the pattern that you'll carry out, because we're not consciously being taught the behavior or taught the pattern, but we're sponges as children and we just tend to observe what we see. And those patterns become normal, I did the air quotes, to us, even when they're unhealthy. And as an adult, we often find ourselves reacting in ways we never intended, because those responses were practiced long before the language, we had language to question it. For example, I have an 18-year-old, soon to be 19-year-old. God bless his heart. And there are times where he would do things that really, family. He does things that really work my nerves. And sometimes I can ignore it, and sometimes I can't. And the times where I cannot ignore it, I find myself doing a couple of things. Depending on what it is, I'll just simply look at him and give him this stare. And he knows exactly what it means. And as I look at myself and think about it, even as I'm telling you now, it's the same stare my mother would give me when I would do something that I knew I had no business doing. And instead of using her words, she used her facial gestures and her eyes. And I knew what it meant. Now, she didn't teach me how to do it. I just learned it because I saw it. And I saw how effective it was. I know how effective it was with me as a child. So what do I do now as a parent? I just simply position my face, look at Jaden, squint my eyes, and he knows exactly what that means. No questions asked. That's a learned behavior. That's a learned pattern. It's one of the most subtle ones and one of the most safest ones, but nonetheless, it's still a pattern. Let's take a look at some common family patterns here, some that we don't want to talk about. Emotional suppression. I'm going to start with that one. Some of us grew up in a home where emotions was not welcome. No shade, no tea. But I do not remember being in a home with my mother or my father where the words "I love you" was used. And I'm 48. It's used now. You know, I speak to my mom now, and she openly expresses her love for me now, but I don't remember it as a kid. And my father, may he rest in peace, I don't remember ever hearing him say, "I love you." Wasn't until his latter years, as I became his caregiver, he didn't say, "I love you," but I knew it was implied. Emotional suppression is real. And unfortunately, it's more real in African American families than it is other families. Don't debate me. I'm an African American, so that's what I know. But in all seriousness, looking at my counterparts, whether it's a Caucasian counterpart, his Hispanic counterpart, whatever nationality, whatever race, I noticed that more so in our families, it's a little bit more intense for us, and we don't always say, "I love you" to our children. It's implied. As children, we know that you love us, but at the same token, it is never verbalized. Instead, what's verbalized in most homes is "stop crying," "you're too sensitive," "get over it," "be strong." All of those are emotionally suppressive. I remember my father, I was a mischievous little kid. Let me just give you that disclaimer, so you'll hear that a lot in my podcast. I remember as a kid, I was doing something, and my dad gave me a beating, whooping, beating, whatever y'all want to call it these days. And I started to cry, right? And in the midst of crying, my father says, "Stop crying before I give you something to cry for." Make that make sense. And I remember one time he said it, and in the midst of crying, I looked at him like, "Am I not crying now?" I dare not verbalize it, but I thought it. These are the things that we tell our children. These are the things that, you know, we absorb. These are the things that we encounter, and we see it as normal now. Or, well, some of us don't see it as normal now, but growing up, we think it's normal. But what it is, it's emotional suppression. Over time, you learn that expressing your emotions is not safe. Instead of processing your feelings, you bury them. So as an adult, it shows up in this way: difficulty expressing your needs, shutting down during conflict, feeling emotionally disconnected, and believing vulnerability is weakness. Let me tell you something. That second one, shutting down during conflict, I do not like to argue. I tell my partners all the time, my partner who I'm with at the time, whoever, whatever, whether it's friendship, relationship, this ship, your ship, my ship, they ship, I don't like conflict. I would avoid conflict at all costs because of two reasons. One, I know me. If it goes too left and it goes too left too long, my mouth can become reckless. Let's just be honest. I told y'all this as a podcast where we tell the truth, right? So my mouth can be viciously reckless. So I avoid conflict based on that. The other thing is I shut down during conflict, meaning once you see me shut down during conflict or once I feel unheard, it's a wrap. Shut down. Nothing else. You will never hear anything else from me. Because in that moment, that's the way I protect myself. And unfortunately, that was something that a way that I learned to protect myself. You weren't really given opportunities now, then growing up as a child, to express your emotions. So you learned to suppress it. You learned to minimize it. You learned to just don't even address it. And as adults, we're still doing things. We're still doing it. We're still perpetuating the pattern. We have difficulty expressing our needs. I said in one of these shows, I'm not sure which one, which season, which episode, whatever. I said that sometimes we expect our husbands, our wives, our partners, whoever, whatever, to know what it is that we need. And that's not fair to them, because why not just say what you need? But the truth of the matter is, let me help somebody in their marriage today. The truth of the matter is your husband can't express what he needs because he was never taught to do so. Your wife can't express what she needs because she was never taught to do so. And if you go back to the birthday episode, if you express what you need and the need doesn't get met, you now learn not to express it because of the disappointment that you've experienced prior to. See how much weight emotional suppression carries? I mean, emotions aren't the enemy. They're information. Ignoring them doesn't make them disappear. It simply gives them another way to surface. We may think that we're doing ourselves a service of just suppressing our emotions. Oh, I'm not going to say nothing. Oh, I'm just going to let it be. Oh, I'm just going to go along to get along. And then what? And then what? Another thing that we develop along the way: people pleasing. Some of us learned very early that love had to be earned. Some of us were praised when you perform well. And so we learned, in order to get any acknowledgement, we had to people please. See, as a child, you don't know it's people pleasing. As a teenager, you don't know it's people pleasing. As a young adult, you don't know it's people pleasing. As an adult, you should know, but sometimes you don't know it's people pleasing. As adults, we become exhausted trying to keep everybody happy. I talked about this a few weeks ago. We try to make everybody happy and not realizing that it is so exhausting. We say yes when we really want to say no. We apologize for things that really aren't our responsibility or wasn't even in our scope or realm of service. We neglect ourselves so others won't be disappointed. Basically, you're pouring from an empty cup. Why? Because you were taught subliminally to people please. People pleasing isn't kindness when it's fueled by fear. It's often a survival strategy rooted in the belief that our value depends on keeping others comfortable. Isn't that the most silliest thing? We feel that in order to be accepted and in order to, you know, be liked or whatever, I have to please someone at the expense of my own health. And I know we can listen to this podcast today at this grown big old age and say, oh, I'd never do that. But the truth of the matter is, somehow, some way along the way, each and every one of us, if we want to be honest, has been a people pleaser. I don't want to go, but I'm just going to go. I don't want to do this, but I'm just going to do it. I don't, you really want to say no. Can you? No, that's what you want to say, but you just say, okay, no problem. I'll do it. I'll get it done. Begrudgingly. Here's another emotion that we suppress, anger. Ooh, I have so much I can say about this one. I have so much I can say in terms of anger with myself, and anger that I saw early on with my son. Damn, these patterns. And you know what's the weirdest thing? I told you these are like family patterns that we continue to perpetuate. I saw my mother when I was a child, how her anger would flare up. I saw it in my father. I saw it, basically in all my siblings, anger. And we believe that everyone who carries anger explodes, and that's not true. Some people direct anger inward. I saw anger in my niece, and that's like a third generation, if you ask me. And I was just like, oh, that's not cute. But it was something that she subliminally learned, not just from her mother and my sister, but from all of us. It's a family pattern that I am trying like hell to break, because now that I see it in my son, it is not cute at all. Oh my God. Let me just stick a pin right here. You ever see your child, or for those of you that has multiple children, your children do something and you cringe because you know exactly what that is. You know exactly what that looks like. And you're like, who taught you that? You did. See, we're not sitting down with pen and paper, pencil and pad, telling our kids, hey, this is how you respond. This is this, this, this. No, we're not doing that. But we're teaching them in a way by how we act and how we move. Some people direct anger inward. Some become emotionally numb. Some people become sarcastic. And I have a very good gift of sarcasm that I try not to use, and some become highly critical, and some of us avoid conflict altogether just to avoid anger. And that was me. Now, that's not to say I run head on to conflict. Excuse me. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am saying, I pick and choose what conflicts I want to deal with, simply because I know me. And if you've heard nothing else on this podcast before we go any further, all of these is knowing who you are and knowing what you're capable of. In order to address these family patterns, you have to be honest with yourself and recognize the pattern of behavior and then say, ooh, okay, yeah, I need to fix that. Healthy anger tells us that something is wrong. Unhealed anger controls how we respond to everything. And sometimes beneath the anger is grief or rejection or just an angry child who never felt heard. Because most of the times we're not just angry just to be angry. We're angry because something has happened. Something has triggered an emotion, a feeling. Something has been triggered. And so now we're angry. Now we're frustrated. Now we're like, there was a time when I was in middle school, I would be so angry that once I start crying, it's almost like, no, not almost. It is like, leave me alone. Because I'm not crying because I'm fearful. I'm crying because I know within my own self what I really want to do but cannot do. So I had to kind of switch up. Because I knew me. I knew what I was capable of. Yeah, anger. Still working on it. What the folks say? God ain't done with me yet. Yeah, he ain't done. Addiction. Oh, good old addiction. Addiction isn't limited to drugs or alcohol, people. We can become addicted to almost anything. addicted to drugs, addicted to alcohol, addicted to work, achievement, shopping, social media, sex, being nasty, being rude, whatever, you know, we know the definition of addiction. We can be addiction to being validated, addiction to being approved, addiction to business, addiction to toxic relationships. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is an addiction, because when you jump out of one toxic relationship that you knew was toxic and jump right back into another one and then another one and then another one, you are now addicted. Because you're addicted to the pattern of behavior for whatever reason that relationship serves you. You know it's toxic. You know she's toxic. You know he's toxic. But you continue to jump into the relationship and continue the pattern of the same thing with the same person. And hey, no shade, no tea, no judgment. But it's an addiction. At its core, addiction often becomes an attempt to numb your pain. And we don't know how to process the pain that you don't know how to process. The question isn't only, why are you addicted? Or what am I addicted to? The deeper question I want us, including myself, to ask ourselves is, what pain am I trying not to feel? Because think about the person that goes to the bar and drink all night. What pain, what issue, what problem are they running from? The person that smokes or snorts cocaine, or does crack, or heroin, or shoot up, whatever your thing is, or the person that jumps out of bed to bed to bed to bed to bed, just promiscuity, having sex everywhere with everybody, and not caring, what pain are you trying to numb? What feeling are you trying to get over and thinking that that thing, that vice is going to help you get over it? What pain are you trying not to feel? When you think about addiction, stop looking at what the person is addicted to and look at why they even created or started the addiction in the first place. Most people, not all, most people that are addicted to some controlled substance, they're addicted to it because there's something that they're suppressing and there's something that they're either running from, something that they're trying not to face, something that they're trying to get over, and they think and thought that smoking and shooting up and drinking and sex and cursing and whatever your vice is, they thought that was going to numb the pain. We can be addicted to bad behavior. Somebody say good morning and you automatically pop off. You're addicted to being nasty. You're addicted to being rude. You're addicted to being vile. That's an addiction. It gives anything that gives you a high, so to speak, is an addiction. So you curse so-and-so out and now you feel good about yourself. And you continue to do that because it creates this feeling of euphoria for you in that moment. But then when you come down off the euphoric feeling, it's like, ugh. It's nothing different. It's nothing different than when you watch these movies, because I'm not gonna point fingers at anybody. When you watch these movies and you see these two people went out and they were at the bar and they had a good time and they were drunk and they went up to the room and they did the do, and then the next morning they wake up side out looking at the person like, what did I do? Yeah. Yeah. Here's another thing, another family pattern that is so prevalent and we never pay attention to. We only pay attention to it when we're talking about poverty. But most of us face financial fear. Money carries emotional meaning. If you grew up in a house or around financial instability, you may constantly fear losing everything, even when you're doing well. Some people overspend because they never had it to spend before. Others refuse to spend because they fear of not having it when they need it. Financial anxiety isn't always about money. Sometimes it's about the pattern of behavior that we've learned. Sometimes it's about that financial safety. True story. I have someone that's very close to me, right? This person is financially, what we will call financially stable, financially intelligent, financially set. Worked a job for 20 something years, retired from the job, still in their 40s. Can they actually pick up another career if they want to? And they're financially set, stable, good pension, good retirement plan, you know, did what they were supposed to do with their money in terms of saving for retirement, yada, yada, all that good stuff, right? This person panics with financial matters. And it's not because they don't have it. The panic and the anxiety is there because there was a time growing up as a child where this person didn't have it. And so because the fear of not having it is real for them, it's always a constant, gotta get it. And they may see it as, oh, I'm just making sure I'm set for my future, instead of acknowledging and recognizing that, hey, this is a real fear for you. It is a real thing for you. And if you don't deal with the root cause, because with any addiction, if you don't deal with the root cause, with any fear, if you don't deal with the root of the fear or the anxiety, all you're doing is putting a Band-Aid over a wound that should have stitches. It doesn't work. So financial fear is real. So when you see a person sometimes, and this is not everybody and not every situation, when you see a person overspending, that might be a financial fear there. The fear might have been, I've never had it to spend, so now I'm going to ball out, make it rain everywhere I go. But if you also see a person that, you know, they're extremely, and I'm talking about super frugal, that's a person who was raised in an environment where they didn't have it. And the fear is, I don't want to ever be in a position where I don't have it. Growing up, my mother, she gonna get mad at me telling y'all all her business, but growing up, my mother was the toiletries queen, right? So meaning my mom would stockpile, this was even before stockpiling was a thing. My mom would stockpile toilet paper, paper towel, toothpaste, you know, toiletries, just little everyday household needs. She would stockpile them as a child. I didn't realize until about 3 months ago that I do the same thing. Now, it's only me and my son. And I stockpile stuff like, girl, what are you preparing for? And it's not because I want to. It's a learned behavior, something that I saw. So in my mind, that's what you do, because that's what my mom did. Never taking the time to ask her why she did it. But now I know why she did it. I mean, it was a household of five children in a home. You had to stockpile. I don't have five children in my home. Why the heck are you stockpiling? Well, I'm stockpiling because it's something that I saw. And because I didn't know the root of why she did it, I automatically learned something and I continued it, not realizing that, hey, you don't need to do that. Anyway, perfectionism. Perfectionism also often disguises itself as excellence. I'm a type A personality. But excellence says, I want to do my best. When perfectionism says, if I'm not perfect, I'm not worthy. There's a difference. It's a difference between displaying excellence or displaying perfectionism, right? Many perfectionists weren't raised to believe mistakes were opportunities to learn. They were raised to believe that mistakes are dangerous. It's bad. You can't make mistakes. You can't afford to do this wrong. You can't afford to get this wrong. So there's no opportunity to teach. There's no teachable moments. So that's how most of us or some people develop the issue of perfectionism. That's a family pattern. Failure felt personal to a person who was raised in a perfectionism mindset. So now everything they do, every mistake they make, it feels like proof that, oh, I'm not good enough. And it could be something so small, but because you were raised in a perfectionism mindset and that's a family pattern, you feel like it's the end of the world. I have a friend, very close friend of mine. She's of Caribbean descent. And for most Caribbean islanders, you kind of, not so much so now, but you kind of used to set the path for what you wanted your children to be, the career that you wanted them to choose or the path that you wanted them to take. And so you raise your children in that manner, in that way. Well, this particular friend, it was already set for her to be a nurse. She was never asked what she wanted to be. She was never given the opportunity to explore. It was just set, you're going to be a nurse. Started out nursing school, was doing pretty well, top of her class, and she got pregnant. Threw a monkey wrench in the plan, and now she's no longer perfect. Now she's scarred her entire life, and everything is going shot to hell because she got pregnant. So she felt like a failure because she broke the pattern of what was supposed to be. She had to be this super perfect student, go to graduate high school, go to college, start your career, don't have children until you're married. It was just this blueprint, and she messed up. And she went through a very traumatic pregnancy because family kind of sort of disowned her because she steered away from what they thought was perfectionism and what she felt like she had to live up to. This quote unquote, what they call mistake, their grandchild, was like a doomsday when they found out she was pregnant. And then you're pregnant without being married. How dare you? So we got to be very careful. Fear of vulnerability. If opening your heart once resulted in rejection, criticism, abandonment, or betrayal, your nervous system may decide vulnerability isn't safe. You may decide, I can't be vulnerable around this person. I can't be vulnerable against this with this group of people. And it creates a sense of independence and isolation. Because when you feel as a person you can't be vulnerable with, let's just say your partner, it creates a sense of independence and isolation. You tend to keep people away from you for the sake of not being hurt or rejected or whatever again. You crave intimacy while fearing it at the same time. Oxymoronic, I know, but it's very true. You want someone to be close and want someone to be there and want someone to be intertwined with your life. But the fear of your vulnerability says, we can't do that. Don't let them get too close for whatever reason. If we let them get too close, we'll get hurt. We'll be rejected. We'll be abandoned. We'll be left behind. Whatever that childhood, that little girl or that little boy in you is saying, that's what keeps you stuck right there. The walls that once protected you eventually become the prison that keeps love out. I told you guys about my client. I told her I needed her to lower the wall a little bit. Didn't need you to let it down. I needed her to lower it so at least you can see out of it. Because here's the thing. We think we build these walls to keep people out. But the truth of the matter is we build these walls and it keeps us from getting out. And it keeps stuff from coming in. That stuff that we really need. You're saying you want to be loved. You're saying you want friendship. You're saying you want this. You're saying you want that. But you can't even come from behind the wall. So that's your fear of being vulnerable. Because yes, I will admit, being vulnerable means sometimes that you will get your feelings hurt. You will feel rejected. You will feel abandoned. You will feel criticized. You will feel like this one walked on my feelings. You will, and I can go on and on. And yes, it's not a good feeling. But think about the flip side to it. You allow yourself to be a little vulnerable at a time, pieces at a time. And the reward, the feeling of feeling what you feel in that moment, it's worth it. You never know what you'll encounter until you allow yourself to be vulnerable. And I know it's not easy, but we do it. So what do we do now? Tell you what, recognize before you replace. You can't change what you haven't identified. Most people want different lives. But hey, we choose to live on autopilot. We repeat the same relationship patterns, the same conversations, the same emotional reactions, the same fears, not because we enjoy them, but because it's familiar. I told you that in the beginning. Awareness is the first act of healing. And so how do we all get healed? Well, glad you asked, like the preacher would say. Ask yourself this question. What am I repeating? Ask yourself, what am I repeating? Do I keep choosing emotional unavailable partners? Do I always end up overgiving? Do I avoid conflict? Do I sabotage my healthy relationships? These patterns don't repeat because we're destined to fail. They repeat because they're often unresolved. So when you ask yourself these questions, what am I repeating? Like what pattern of behavior I'm repeating? And you really be honest with yourself, because who lies to themselves? That's a whole nother topic, John. When you finally be honest with yourself and say, listen, we keep doing the same thing. Self says, huh? You know we keep doing the same thing, right? And self says, oh, shoot, you're right, we do. Then you have to say, so what are we going to do different, self? And then the conversation and healing can begin. Another thing I want you to ask yourself, what am I tolerating? Maybe you're not repeating it, but you're tolerating it. Sometimes the issue isn't only what we're doing, it's what we've convinced ourselves to accept. Are you tolerating disrespect because you're mistaking it for normalcy? Are you accepting inconsistency because that's all you've ever known? Are you accepting toxic behavior because that's all you've ever seen and you feel like that's the only types of people that will love you? What are you tolerating? You know you can't stomach it, but for the sake of having it, you tolerate it. And why? Healing raises our standards, not because we're becoming demanding, but because we're recognizing our own worth. Here's another question I want you to ask yourself. What do I believe about myself because of my past? I'm dark skinned. You cannot mistake me for any other culture but Black, African American, whatever the labels are these days. I'm dark skinned. And one of the things that I was teased about in middle school was the complexion of my skin. And here's the crazy thing. I was teased about it by people who had the same skin color. Make it make sense. So being teased in middle school about being dark skinned, so dark or whatever, I was called names that to this day I laugh at now because it's like, really? That's what you was really calling me? But that pattern of behavior made me believe to a certain degree that there was something wrong with being this dark. And for a long time, going into high school, I didn't like the tone of my skin. I didn't like the darkness, the rich darkness of my skin. I didn't like it. Because middle school and them little hateful cheering in middle school made me feel insecure about being dark skinned. This is why I say childhood experiences often create silent beliefs. Things that are done to us in our childhood or in our formative years, whatever have you, sometimes cause us to believe that we're hard to love. We have to earn to acceptance, that we're responsible for everyone's happiness. You can't trust anybody. And absolutely, I am not enough. Told you guys the story about how loving me is enough got started. Being criticized and called names about my skin tone was traumatic for me, but I didn't realize it was traumatic for me until I was in my adulthood. So ask yourself, what do I believe about myself because of my past experiences? Then go further. Once you identify it, like for me with the whole Black thing, ask yourself, is this belief helping me or is it holding me back? Is this belief producing peace or fear? Connection or isolation? For me, that belief created fear. So now I became self-conscious of my skin tone and it created isolation. It did not create growth. It created stagnation because what I could have been doing in those years in terms of embracing who I was, in terms of my skin tone, it took me years to retrain and rethink and get over the fact that, girl, you are the color that you are, and that is it. And that is enough. That's acceptable. That's it. You don't need any other caveat to go with it. But not every belief we've carried deserves to follow us into the next season of our lives. And that's what I had to tell myself. And that's what I'm asking you to understand today. Not every belief that you carry have to continue to go with you. Right? Can't continue to be Erykah Badu with your bags. At some point, we have to let them go. At some point, we have to put them down. And it all starts with giving yourself permission to forgive yourself. We don't know what we don't know when we don't know it. So releasing the weight without rewriting what happened is what I want us to do. Forgiveness is one of the most misunderstood words in healing. Sometimes we believe forgiving means pretending it didn't happen. That's not true. Other times we think forgiveness means immediately restoring relationships. That certainly is not true. Neither one of those mean you have to do what it says. But let me tell you what forgiveness is. Because the church preaches about forgiveness. It teaches about forgiveness. And it's great because the Bible says that we must forgive in order to be forgiven. And that's cool. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm not going against biblical principles. What I am saying, we need to take a deeper look at what forgiveness does. Because I can tell you what unforgiveness does. See, the church is so quick to tell us this. My soapbox, give me a minute. The church is so quick to tell us what unforgiveness does, but it doesn't gives us the freedom to know what forgiveness does. So I'll tell you. Forgiveness is not saying what happened was acceptable. Forgiveness is not minimizing your abuse, your neglect, your betrayal, or your abandonment. Forgiveness is not removing the accountability either. What forgiveness is? Forgiveness is choosing not to allow bitterness to become your permanent residence. I'm going to say that again. Forgiveness is choosing not to allow bitterness to become your permanent residence. It's choosing not to stay in that cycle, that pattern of behavior, not to allow yourself to stay stagnated in a place that you don't want to be. We often criticize Tyler Perry movies, but here's one line that I took from that movie to be true. Forgiveness is never for the other person. The forgiveness is for you. It's to free you from this cage of bondage that you put yourself in, holding on to what was done. Forgiveness says, open the cage, birdie, and fly. Because most of the time, scratch that. 100% of the time, the grudge that you're holding, the unforgiveness that you're holding, the resentment that you're holding, the person that you're holding it against, they have moved on with their lives and didn't care less about your feelings. And here you are, still stuck in unforgiveness. And the person who did it said it. They have moved on. Ladies and gentlemen, that is what forgiveness is. Is giving yourself permission to be free from it. No, you're not going to forget it. I hate that statement. Forgive and forget. The devil is a liar. You can forgive. You may never forget. And that's okay. Forgiveness doesn't mean because after I forgave you, we jump right back where we left. No, I get to choose. That's what forgiveness says. I get to choose whether or not I want to stay in communication, in relationship, in this boat with you. That's what forgiveness gives me. It gives me the opportunity to be free. Fly, bird, fly. There are relationships where reconciliation is healthy, and there's also relationships where reconciliation should never be an option. I'm divorced. I remember my divorce decree saying irreconcilable differences. That means at no way, at no juncture, at no path, we can reconcile what we had. Best way I know how to put it. Legally on that paperwork, it says irreconcilable differences. We cannot reconcile what we have. I can forgive you. I can move forward, but we cannot move forward together because it's irreconcilable. There are also situations where forgiveness and distance can coexist. I can forgive you and still choose boundaries. You can forgive someone and still stay. That's your choice. But make sure it's a choice that you can live with that doesn't recreate a pattern of feeling for you. That's what forgiveness is. That's the piece the church forgets to tell us. Sometimes forgiveness is less about freeing the other person and more about refusing to let the offense continue to control your heart. Every time you choose not to let it go or forgive, that's a person having power and control over you. And we will talk more about power control in another episode. But for the sake of this episode, power, and you give that person power and control over you because you have not forgiven them. You want to get your power back? You want to get your control back? Forgive them and let it go and move on. Nothing hurts an offender more than you saying, you know what? I forgive you. Because now what else do they have? It's like the story of Jesus going into the grave and walking out and taking back the keys and saying, oh, death, where is your sting? Basically, now that I've taken back everything, come on, Holy Ghost. What you got left? I'm a preacher, so I can say what I say. But no, seriously, let's think about it. If you take back your power and you take back your control, what does that person have left? I'll tell you, absolutely nothing. Absolutely no thing to hold against you. But I'll get off my soapbox and we'll move on. After you've forgiven yourself, now it's time to do some work. Now it's time to get down to the nitty-gritty. We're going to create new patterns. Healing isn't only about what you leave behind. It's about what you intentionally build. So now that you've forgiven, now that you've made a conscious decision to move on, now that you've made a conscious decision to identify these unhealthy patterns of behavior, these unhealthy cycles, now that you're more aware of it, now let's start putting things in place. Go back a few episodes. First thing you're going to do is set healthy boundaries. Boundaries aren't walls to keep everybody out. They're guidelines to protect your peace, your values, and your well-being. A boundary says, I care about you, but I also have a responsibility to care for myself. Healthy people respect healthy boundaries. So that's the first thing you're going to do. Set healthy boundaries. In this whole creating new patterns, you're going to set healthy boundaries. Second thing you're going to do, learn emotional regulation. We talked about anger, right? But let's talk about emotional regulation. Healing doesn't mean you'll never feel angry, fearful, sad, or disappointment. It means those emotions no longer make every decision for you. You know when you're angry, you make decisions you can't live with tomorrow. Emotional regulation allows you to pause before reacting. Think before you speak. Take 10. Take 10. 10 seconds. Is this helpful or is this hurtful? Breathe. We underestimate the power of breathing. Let me tell you, breathing saves lives, literally. Breathe before speaking. Choose your response instead of being controlled by your impulsivity. That's a strength. That's a flex. Anytime you can choose your power to not respond or respond, baby, that's the flex, because the old you would have popped off, but the new you, who's more aware of the and who's willing to create new patterns, has taken a deep breath, looked at the situation, looked at the person, and said, this isn't worth it. Third thing you're going to do, practice honest communication. We were taught to avoid difficult conversations, but healing invites us to communicate with honesty and compassion. Instead of assuming that people know what we need, you need to learn to express it. Instead of bottling up the resentment, address the issue before it becomes an emotional explosion. Hey, I didn't like it when you did such and such. Can I talk to you for a second? You know, last week when you did so and so, it took me a minute, but I wanted to da 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 da. Healthy communication creates healthy relationships. And for those of you that are married, no, he can't read your mind, sis. You have to have the conversation. And bruh, she certainly can't read your mind. You need to have the conversation. Do what I used to tell my students all the time. Use your words, but use them in a healthy way. Here's another thing. Choose relationships that reflect respect and mutual care. Now, you can't tell me you respect yourself and you with a partner that constantly disrespects you every chance that he or she gets. Stop chasing people who don't choose you. That's just the bottom line. Become less interested in chaos and drawn more to consistency and peace. Recognize that love isn't proven through suffering. Let me rephrase that in a way that we understand. I know he loved me because he beat me. That's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie. And know this. Anybody, male or female, and I'm saying this to both genders, that have to put their hands on you to prove their love to you, that's a relationship. I strongly suggest to my Christian brothers and sisters, I beseech you, brethren, to move and walk away. No one, and I mean absolutely no one, should have to put their hands on you to prove their love and affection for you. That is unhealthy and it is toxic. And it goes to both men and women. No woman should be putting her hands on a man. No man should be putting his hands on a woman in that way. And that's all I'm going to say. Allow yourself to experience peace without feeling guilty. For a lot of us, peace feels unfamiliar. When I tell people I can stay in my house all day, like I did today, and be happy and content, they're like, what? Really? You didn't go nowhere? No, because I love the peace that I've created in my home. I love the feeling of knowing just, yes. Some of us, when life becomes too calm, we unconsciously create drama because we're so used to chaotic vibes. Healing teaches us that peace isn't boring. Peace is a gift. You don't have to earn rest. You don't have to apologize for being happy. You don't have to wait until everything is perfect before you allow yourself to breathe and have peace. The greatest evidence that you're healing isn't that life becomes perfect, it's that you no longer need dysfunction to feel alive. That's the best flex right there. Knowing that I no longer need to have this dysfunctional situation going on in order to feel alive. Who won't want that? So let's continue to do our work. Recognize your family patterns that has been holding you hostage. Once you recognize you're going to replace, but before you replace, ask yourself, what am I repeating? What am I tolerating? What do I believe about myself because of my past? And is that belief helping me or is it holding me back? And once you recognize and start replacing, start with forgiveness. Give yourself the permission to fly in to be free and then create new patterns. And in creating new patterns, ladies and gentlemen, that simply means setting healthy boundaries, learning emotional regulation, practicing honest communication, choosing relationship that reflects respect, mutual care, and allowing yourself the experience of peace without feeling guilty. Now, for my saved folks, those that believe in the Lord, Romans 12 and 2, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Ezekiel 36 and 26, it says that I will give you a new heart. That I means God. Some of us need heart transplants. Allow God to do that. It's time that we live in our most healthiest lives, in our most healthiest states, in our most healthiest era. Now, is doing these episodes triggering? Probably so. But here's the thing. I rather put it all out there so someone else can heal as much as I have healed. Did I have childhood trauma? Absolutely. And I told you guys last week, trauma that I didn't even know was there, but it was. And so because I've dealt with it and I know what it feels like to live in peace and have peace and peace of mind, I want you to have the same. So, with that being said, we're getting ready to wrap up and get on up out of here. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope something was said that will cause you to think differently, live differently, and choose differently. Because at the end of the day, know this and understand that loving you is enough. Until next time. Believe in who you are. You're the